From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Maxine Hong Kingston has written two literary memoirs that explored Chinese-American culture and that earned Kingston some of the most prestigious awards in literature. On this edition of Fresh Air, Kingston talks about her first novel, Tripmaster Monkey. Also, we continue our discussion with actor and director Bob Balaban. Today he talks about his roles in such films as Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Prince of the City, and he explains why he's too often confused with Richard Dreyfuss. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles soul singer Irma Thomas, and book critic John Leonard reviews Citizens, historian Simon Shama's account of the French Revolution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Maxine Hong Kingston has written eloquently and movingly about Chinese Americans. Her first memoir, The Woman Warrior, won the 1976 National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. It was about her childhood, growing up in the laundry run by her immigrant parents. Her mother tried to tell her about the world through family legends about ancestors and ghosts. Kingston has written, "Those of us in the first American generations have had to figure out how the invisible world the immigrants built around our childhoods fits in solid America." Maxine Hong Kingston's second book, China Men, was about the men of her family who left China for America. It won the American Book Award for General Nonfiction in 1981. Kingston's new book, Tripmaster Monkey, is her first novel. It's set in San Francisco in the 60s, and it's the story of a 23-year-old Berkeley graduate and playwright named Whitman Ah Sing. Throughout the book, he keeps up a running commentary on everything he's read, from Rilke to Kerouac, on the movies he's seen, and on the records he's listening to, and what they say to him as a Chinese-American. Kingston told me why, after two memoirs, she wrote a novel.
Well, this is what came to me, and I wasn't thinking about genre at all. It was that this character, Whitman Ah Sing, came to me in my imagination, and I found that I was talking to him, imagining him, arguing with him, and he came to me in dreams, and I followed him around, trying to think of what actions he might create, what kind of a life he might have, and so it's a novel because there is this fascinating person, but he's not a real person.
This person is so different from you are. I was really surprised when I started reading your book. Well, yeah. I think so, yeah, in the sense that, one, he's a man and you're a woman. He's fifth generation Chinese-American.
Yes.
You're first. First generation born in America. He's from a kind of showbiz background.
Yes.
Mother in the Floridora Girls. And you're not. It seems to me that you chose someone with a really different kind of voice and background from yours.
Yeah, but in many ways the same. I do have people in my family that are in show business, and there's when I think of gambling houses, that's in show business, and Whitman is a young person in the 60s, and I was too, and he's an English major who created himself and his life by reading, and I did that also. Part of him, even though in some ways he doesn't seem like me, his language is my language. After writing those other two books, I had a desire to work in a language where I wasn't translating other people from Chinese into English, and trying to find a language of that would beautifully show the people actually speaking in Chinese, and Whitman is speaking the most current American language I could find. And in that sense, he's me. He has my education. He has my language.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up his language, because I want you to read a section that I think will show something about the language he speaks and the language that he likes and wants. And this is from early on in the book.
Yeah, this is Witmanas Singh and a girlfriend, and they're walking through Chinatown. And he's thinking, is this it? I mean, what is Chinese-American culture? Do we have any culture? What theater do we have besides beauty contests? Do we have a culture that's not these knick-knacks we sell to the Bakwai? If Chinese-American culture is not knick-knackatory, look at it. Back-scratchers, swizzle sticks, pointed chopsticks for the hair, Jade East aftershave in a Buddha-shaped bottle, the head screws off and you pour lotion out of its neck. Then what is it? No other people sell out their streets like this. Tourists can't buy up J-Town. Wait a goddamn minute. We don't make Jade East. It's one of your Hakujin products by Swank. Would we do that to you? Make Jesus on the cross bottles, so every morning all over the country, hairy men twist his head off and pour this green stuff out of his neck? So what do we have in the way of a culture besides Chinese hand laundries? You might make a joke on that, something about what's the difference between a Chinese hand laundry and a French laundry. Where's our jazz? Where's our blues? Where's our ain't taking no shit from nobody's street-strutting language? I want so bad to be the first bad jazz China man, blues man of America. Of all the music on the airwaves, there's one syllable that sounds like ours. It's in that song by the Coasters. It'll take an ocean of calamine lotion, poison ivy. No, not the ivy part. It's where they sing around. Right there. That's a Chinese opera run. A Coaster must have been among those black guys you see at the Chinese movies and at dojos seeking kung fu power.
Now, you said that this character's voice was a lot like yours. In the 60s, were you thinking, where's our jazz, where's our blues, where's our street-strutting language?
Yeah, I was thinking, how are we Chinese-Americans part of all this? And I was also, in a wider way, I picked this period that it's the 60s that's before the hippies. It's before the hippies and yippies. It's sort of the dark time after the beatniks and before the hippies. And that was a crucial period. Where are we going? What is the next art that we are going to create?
You know, the voice that you have the character speaking in is this really macho swagger kind of voice.
Yeah.
Where language is style and there's this boldness in it. And I think back to your book, your first book, The Woman Warrior, and talking about how you really hated school because you had to speak.
Yeah.
And you had a small voice and you hated to speak.
Yeah.
And you still speak pretty quietly, I have to say, hearing you speak now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a lifelong struggle to find the voice of the writer and also to find voice as a human being and all kinds of voices, political voice, the bravery to speak up, the ability to create myself as a person. All of that has to do with finding voice.
Do you have a different voice in your mind than you do vocally?
No, it's pretty much the same one.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Although as I read this, I remember that one language habit that I bring back, that I bring from the 60s. You know, I chose this period also because I love the language that was being formed. I mean, these words that people were inventing in order to describe new psychedelic states and visions for the new society, words that would describe the Zen gestures to bring about civil rights and to bring about the end of the war in Vietnam, all these flower power words. I mean, I wanted to write about that period because of the language of the time, and I see that the words that I still use are, I mean, I look at something and I just say, oh wow. I mean, I think people have forgotten now that people used to say that all the time. Oh wow, and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Maxine Hung Kingston, who's written a new novel called Tripmaster Monkey. I'm thinking back again to The Woman Warrior, where you wrote that you had to change your voice to be American feminine.
Mm-hmm.
What was the difference between the Chinese female voice and the American feminine voice in your mind?
Well, what I was thinking about there is that the women around me, my mother and people of her generation, the people who came from the peasant villages of China and then came to America and worked in the fields in the San Joaquin Valley, I mean, these women have such strong voices. They shout. They don't have social shame. You know, they can go into a library or any elegant place and they unself-consciously yell at one another. And they don't think of it as yelling. It's just good, strong, loud, peasant talking and communication. And in comparison, I could see that American women who are feminine have soft, sweet, nice, quiet voices. And I was wondering, well, how can I speak? If I speak like my mother, then it's so unattractive. But if I speak softly, like the American girls that I saw around me, then it's not loud enough. It's not powerful enough. So how do I speak? So that was the problem I was wrestling with in that book and at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, one more thing on the subject of speaking. You also tell the story of how when you were a baby, your mother cut the frenum, which is that little string-like muscle that connects the tongue to your mouth.
Yeah, so she says that she did that, yeah.
She says that she did it to loosen your tongue and so that you could speak in any language.
Yeah.
Now, you were very young, if this indeed really happened. You don't remember it happening.
I sort of remember, and I think it might have been because she might have done it to another one of the kids. So I sort of remember seeing it, but I don't know.
To me, it's this incredible image of metaphor and reality really mixing, you know, that it's a nice metaphor to like loosen somebody's tongue, but to do it in reality by slicing into it.
I actually think she did it in reality because my mother is, while a very imaginative woman, she's also entirely real. And she's very good at bringing dream and vision into reality, creating reality.
When she told you that she'd done that, what was your first reaction?
I had a lot of paranoid feelings, too. I thought, also, what if she made a mistake and she cut my tongue and then I can't speak? What if that happened? What if the results of that backfires? And maybe that's why I don't speak well.
And is this the kind of thing you could actually talk with her about?
Sometimes, very indirectly, or when I feel very brave, I'll bring up something. Or just recently, I asked her, maybe it wasn't even me, but sometimes I get a lot of backup now from my sisters and from the nieces, and who are, now they're like second, third generation Americans, and these nieces read my books, and then they get very curious, and they want to go over to Grandma. And they want to know, there were a bunch of them, and they were saying, this ghost that sat on your chest, I mean, did that happen? What was it like? And And then my mother says, then she gets right away. She goes into her talk story, and she tells them about, how it sat on her chest. It was so hairy, and she says, and there was this foot sticking out of it. And I'm thinking, well, why didn't she tell me there was a foot? Then I could have gotten it into the book. See, she still keeps remembering details or making it up or whatever, but there's this constant change and aliveness.
Do you ever think in the back of your mind that your mother cutting that part of your tongue really did loosen it up and it helped you write?
Yes. Yes, maybe it does work that way. And actually, when I see the results, I do think that I have a very loose tongue. I can't keep secrets. I mean, she tells me, don't tell, and then I tell everything. So I guess I have done that, yes.
Well, let's talk more, but first let's take a short break first. My guest is Maxine Hahn Kingston, and her new book is her first novel. It's called Tripmaster Monkey. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Maxine Hahn Kingston is my guest. Her literary memoirs, The Woman Warrior and Chinaman, were landmarks in Chinese-American literature. She's now written her first novel, Tripmaster Monkey. You grew up with your mother doing talk story. Would you explain what that is?
Well, it's a Chinese cultural tradition that I imagine goes back to pre-literate times when people passed on culture and ideas and philosophy and how to do things by putting them into stories. And I think the form is so wonderful because every time you tell a story, the story changes. The same person can tell the same story, and each time it's different because you look at the child, you look at the person that you're talking to for cues. What are they? What do they need right now? Do they need a scary story? A story of that would admonish them? Do they need a rite of passage story? Do they need a soothing story? And the story changes moment by moment as you look into the other person's face. These are the stories that became the basis for Three Kingdoms, for Monkey, and for all those Chinese novels and operas. First, they were talk story. There are modern ones, and they are also, you come home from work and you tell the story of what happened to you today. Talk story keeps a community together. My parents, the laundry, you know, people would come in with letters from professional letter writers in China. They read them aloud. This is the community, knowing one another's business. And Talk Story keeps a community alive.
Do you see your books as an extension of Talk Story?
Yes, yes. I had to work very hard to find literary ways to replicate the variousness, the many voices of Talk Story, the way the story can change from telling to telling. I've tried to find literary ways to not freeze the stories. So I found various ways of telling four versions at once, telling the long version and the short version. And having personalities, telling the same story from various personalities and seeing how it comes out. And so I think I feel successful sometimes in being able to get some of the qualities of Talk Story, even though I'm a writer.
growing up, you really felt that in Chinese culture, girl babies and girls weren't valued in the same way that boy babies and boys were. And you rebelled against that in several ways and mm-hmm. rebelled against the expectations for girls. You didn't want to be a slave or a wife.
So yes.
You learned to cook badly intentionally. You used to crack dishes sometimes when you'd be forced to wash them.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about how you were kind of torn between, like, being a Chinese woman and American feminine and what the requirements of each were. What was it like for you when you were exposed to feminism and there was a kind of third alternative of what a woman could be?
Actually, there was an alternative from the beginning, which I didn't recognize until I became stronger and wiser. Because at the same time that my mother would talk story about the conditions of slavery in China, she all along was giving me the chant of Fa Muglan, the woman warrior. I mean, this was one of the ways I learned to talk. I was chanting the chant of the woman warrior. And so all along she was saying, there is this other way to be, of being very masculine, of going into battle and fulfilling filial obligations by taking your father's place in battle. You could almost be a man. There's a history of swordswomen in China. And actually, we were going to the kung fu movies all the time, where it's always Angela Mao that wins in the Bruce Lee movies. Now, Bruce Lee loses battles once in a while, but Angela never did. So I had that all along. So when I came to feminism, actually, I felt that, oh, here are people who think the same way I do. It wasn't that I was exposed to new ideas. I had to struggle to find ways to integrate all this, to find... I didn't like the woman warrior either. I didn't...
You mean the idea of the woman warrior? The attitude of the woman warrior?
Yeah.
What about it didn't you like?
Well... even now, sometimes I think I don't like calling that book The Woman Warrior, because as I got wiser and older, I also become more and more of a pacifist. And I was writing that book towards the beginning of the Vietnam War, and I was thinking the ways of the sword are not the right methods. These are not the ways to bring about a better world. We've got to find other, more nonviolent Zen gestures.
You know, it interests me that with all of your interest in women and the image of the woman warrior, and whether that's the image that you want to model your life on, that your last two books are about men.
Yeah. Well, you know, I see my these three books as a long struggle as an artist and as a person. I started out maybe for 35 years. The only point of view that I had was the eye. I wrote the first person point of view for so long. And I began to see that, I mean, I got very unhappy and frustrated, thinking, my God, what a selfish person, what a self-centered person and writer, and what an unskillful writer. I can't even do a third-person pronoun. I can't even do an omniscient voice. I can't even put two people in a scene as equals. So I struggled with that artistically for a long time. And there is a chapter in The Woman Warrior which I break into a third-person voice and do an omniscient point of view, but then I sunk right back into the first person again by the last chapter. In China Men, that is a book that it seems as if it is about a lot of men and heroes, but It is a first-person point of view. That same I tells those stories. But, you know, as I struggled along telling about those men, more and more they became real people unto themselves. And the I begins to fade more and more into the background. And these men begin to speak for themselves. The I becomes a listener. And then by this book, by Tripmaster Monkey, I finally learned to let everyone speak for themselves. And I actually disappears. That narrator that I started out with 40 years ago, that I disappears.
I imagine it was somewhat painful and disconcerting to your parents to watch you grow up in America without a real firsthand understanding of the culture that they were from in China, just as it is for so many immigrants who come to America and watch their children grow up in a different culture from the one they grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've watched your children grow up more assimilated than you were. Or at least that's what my guess would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what that's been like for you.
Well, I have one child.
Okay.
And a boy. And he's about Whitman Ah Sing's age. And actually, I don't think anybody assimilates. Nobody assimilates. The task is, how do you integrate very many different elements? This is a task of all of us. We all live in a multicultural America now. And how do we integrate all of its elements? I mean, how do I integrate this Chinese-American past and the life of in the 60s? How do I integrate the Vietnam War into my life? And my son, actually, he has solved this in such interesting ways. I mean, we took him to Hawaii and raised him mostly there. And here he is, a Chinese, Jewish, Portuguese, Irish American. And I think that the more elements you have to fight, to struggle, to integrate, the more complex and interesting new personality and culture you come out with. And I see that the way he has solved it is he has become a Hawaiian, and he sings the ancient Hawaiian songs and plays the music. And that is the way they communicate in their culture. They have talk story, they have the chants, they have the hula, and they have the music. And if you do those things, you are a Hawaiian. And that makes me realize that all of this isn't done by race. It's done with culture. We communicate with communities.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us a little bit about your life. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Maxine Hong Kingston. Her new novel is called Tripmaster Monkey, and it's published by Knopf. Her earlier books are China Men and The Woman Warrior. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Colonel David Hackworth. He's America's most decorated living soldier, but during the Vietnam War he became disillusioned, bitterly ended his 25-year Army career, and went into exile in Australia. Colonel Hackworth is reputedly the model for Marlon Brando's character in the film Apocalypse Now. He's just written an autobiography. It's called About Face, The Odyssey of an American Warrior. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the new movie Parents, Bob Balaban makes his directing debut. But Balaban is still best known as an actor. Coming up in the second half of our interview, Bob Balaban talks about playing a district attorney in Prince of the City and the befuddled cartographer-turned-translator in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Also, rock historian Ed Ward examines how circumstances kept one of the great voices in soul music, Irma Thomas, from gaining the audience she deserves. And book critic John Leonard reviews Citizens. It's a new look at the French Revolution from historian Simon Chama, author of The Embarrassment of Riches. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. There was a shakeup today of the Soviet Communist Party's Central Committee. The move is widely seen as strengthening the position of President Mikhail Gorbachev at a time when his policy of perestroika is under fire. Lisa Dobbs reports from Moscow.
According to the party's ideology chief, Vadim Medvedev, almost a third of the people with voting power on the Central Committee lost the jobs which had entitled them to seats on the committee in the first place, but they remained on the Central Committee after losing those positions because elections to the committee are only held every 5 years. But Medvedev told a press conference this evening that those people had simply asked to resign and their requests were granted. Called the dead souls, these Central Committee members were considered conservatives and possible opponents of Gorbachev's efforts to restructure Soviet society. In the shakeup, 24 of Gorbachev's supporters have been given voting power. That makes the Central Committee smaller, now with 251 members instead of 301. At the press conference, ideology chief Medvedev distanced the leadership in Moscow from the recent bloodshed in Soviet Georgia, saying the decision to order troops to attack the demonstrators was made by local officials, and Moscow was only informed later. For National Public Radio, this is Lisa Dobbs in Moscow.
Assistant Secretary of State Michael Kozak today labeled as fiction a key document used in the criminal trial of Oliver North. Responding to questions from a House subcommittee, Kozak said information in the document linking USA to Honduras to that country's support for Nicaraguan rebels represented only North's version of events. Kozak said the information introduced by North's defense attorney offered an extremely distorted record. Kozak's remarks came on the fourth day of jury deliberations in North's criminal trial. House Speaker Jim Wright defended himself before reporters today, while the man who originally brought charges against Wright, Republican Whip Newt Gingrich, went on the defensive. NPR's Cokie Roberts has details.
While lawyers for Jim Wright and the Ethics Committee negotiate the time frame for the next stage of the investigation into the speaker, Wright insisted today he knew nothing of the oil well deal made by his partner George Malik and the profits placed in Wright's blind trust. Top members of the Ethics Committee and the panel's lawyer went to Texas yesterday to look into that deal. When the committee made its report on Wright recently, members had reached no conclusion on that particular financial arrangement. The financial arrangements surrounding the publication of Newt Gingrich's book have been brought to the attention of the Ethics Committee by Arkansas Democrat Bill Alexander. He claims the money from the partnership which Gingrich formed to promote and sell a book written by himself and his wife was actually used by Gingrich to promote himself and his candidacy for Republican leader. Alexander has filed formal charges with the Ethics Committee, and some members of the House now fear that a tit-for-tat situation has emerged on ethics issues that could last through the entire Congress. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Japanese Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita said today that he would resign, but will actually put off leaving office until a new national budget is put in place. Takeshita has been under fire for his role in a financial scandal. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party has 40 days to select a successor. President Bush acknowledged today that tough talks lie ahead in efforts to reduce the massive federal budget deficit. On the second day of a four-day trip, Bush told aerospace workers in Palo Alto, California, that the nation must be more competitive to sustain the economic recovery. While challenging the nation to keep up with other countries in technological innovation, Bush did not offer any new initiatives. The president instead renewed his appeal to reduce the capital gains tax to 15% from its current rate of 28%. On Wall Street, stock prices fell today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 15 points to close at 23.86.91. Advances, rather declines, led advances. This is NPR in Washington.
This is fresh air. If singer Irma Thomas had begun her career in New York or Los Angeles instead of her native New Orleans, she might have achieved greater fame and fortune. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the way things turned out, she's attained moderate success with some fantastic music.
New Orleans piano player Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, has a song called Right Place, Wrong Time. But when it comes to Irma Thomas, the soul queen of New Orleans, it should be Wrong Place, Right Time. Although she's possessed of one of the great voices in soul music, during her heyday, she was all but unknown by the majority of America's record buyers, black or white. But as she herself once sang, time was on her side. Her career began inauspiciously enough. At the age of 14, she'd been doing a little singing around town, but she found herself pregnant and was kicked out of school. She married the child's father, but the marriage didn't last. By 18, she was remarried and had another kid. Somebody asked her to make a record after hearing her singing with Tommy Ridgely's band. She did, and it was a classic.
You can have my husband, but please don't mess with my man. You can have my husband, but please don't mess with my man. I'm telling all you women, I want you all to understand.
Don't Mess With My Man went to number 22 in 1959, and somehow Irma found time to tour, clocking in 100,000 miles with her band in a Mercury station wagon. But the follow-up didn't click, and that was that. It wasn't until 2 years later that a couple of guys she knew started a label and asked her to record for them, and the Irma Thomas story had a second chapter. Established her in New Orleans, and she and producer Alan Toussaint came up with some classics, like this gospel-tinged number.
One day I couldn't stop crying. The tears kept on flowing. The pain in my heart kept on bleeding. But I love you. I give you my heart. I give you my soul.
But it was on the ballads that Irma Thomas really shone, songs like It's Raining, which became her signature song, even though, like the rest of her classics on the Minute label, it never broke nationally. By 1963, it was becoming apparent that Minute wasn't going to have any hits with Irma Thomas, although they'd been doing well with other New Orleans artists. So she released one more record, another great one, and another flop.
Ruler of my heart, robber of my soul, where can you be? I wait patiently. My heart cries out. Where can you be? I wait patiently.
What was particularly galling was that this record launched another performer's career when Otis Redding rewrote it somewhat into Pain in My Heart, which became his first big hit, and which, Irma admits today, gave her a pain and not in her heart either. But by 1964, she had pain in her heart, too, as her second marriage was dissolving and she found her minute contract bought out by Imperial Records, which meant she'd have to go on performing. She sat down and wrote a song about her life.
Sitting home alone, thinking about my past, wondering how I made it and how long it's gonna last. Success has come to lots of them, and failure's always there.
Age of 23, with four children and no husband, Irma Thomas finally knew success as Wish Someone Would Care climbed into the pop top 20. Her next record, Anyone Who Knows What Love Is, had Time Is On My Side on its flip, but Irma never tasted a hit again. After a short career with Chess Records, she packed up her family and moved to Los Angeles, where she worked at Montgomery Ward, only returning to New Orleans occasionally to perform. In 1975, the Soul Queen of New Orleans married her third husband, Emil Jackson, and moved back home. She does commercials these days and tours the blues circuit here and in Europe. If she'd been anywhere but New Orleans when she was doing her best work, she'd be better known than she is. But according to people who know her, she's happy. And how many soul queens can say that?
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Irma Thomas's latest album, The Way I Feel, is on Rounder Records. This is Fresh Air. Actor Bob Balaban made his directorial debut in the new comic horror film Parents. It stars Randy Quaid and Mary Beth Hurt as a suburban couple in the 1950s who are parents of a 10-year-old boy. They look like the perfect family, but the parents have a ghoulish secret. Yesterday, Balaban talked with us about directing. Today, he talks about being an actor. He co-starred in such films as Absence of Malice, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Altered States, and Dead Bang. To learn about directing, Balaban apprenticed himself to Sidney Lumet, who directed Balaban in Prince of the City. In that film, Balaban played a ruthless federal prosecutor who in this scene is trying to convince a corrupt cop to cooperate.
Gino, you have a very enviable reputation in the department and in the city. You're a hero. How's it gonna look if your force is to take you downtown and book you? Gino Moscone's the top cop. Everyone looks up to Moscone. But Gino, you and I know you're a whore. Just a poor old whore who bellies up for any crook with $2. A whore and a thief. As far as I'm concerned, you have only two options. You cooperate with us, you make the calls, or you go to jail with the other thieves. I don't even want to think about the third option.
In your acting parts in movies, you always seem to play the white-collar professional.
Mm-hmm.
You were a scientist or a scientist-like person in Altered States, 2010, Close Encounters, where you were also a cartographer.
Although in the beginning I was a translator, but they changed
that. That's right. And then a government investigator in Absence of Malice, a parole officer in Dead Bang. Why do you think you get all these white-collar professional roles?
Because I look like a white-collar professional, basically, I guess. I think that what happened was I used to get cast a lot in things because I didn't seem like an actor, because I looked like the person that was actually doing the thing they were supposed to be doing. And I guess my career has primarily been doing things where you looked like a real person, you mm-hmm. know, where you seemed like pretty much what you walked in like. And I guess I tend to be a little cerebral sometimes, although I'm trying to be less. And I guess I've gotten typecast somewhat in what you've just mentioned. But as far as I'm concerned, it's not a bad type to be, because there's a lot of range within there, and at least I've been working.
Mm-hmm. You were in two movies with Richard Dreyfuss, Close Encounters, and Whose Life Is It Anyway?
Yes, and he appeared in one second in my short film as well.
Were you ever confused for each other?
Yes, all the time, which is quite amazing, because we look nothing alike, and yet we do have the same little chickenpox scar right in the middle of our forehead, but I don't think that's what people think that. When I did Close Encounters, we were always mistaken for each other, because Richard had just done Jaws, or recently done Jaws, and in Close Encounters, I had glasses and a beard very similar to what Richard had had in Jaws, and Richard had shaved everything and had gained 25 pounds and didn't really look like the public persona that people knew him to be from Jaws. So it was kind of natural, I think, that people thought that I was Richard.
Did you have to do anything to try to distinguish yourself from him?
Yes, in the movie of Close Encounters, since Richard didn't have a beard, Steven Spielberg said, I think in this movie you're going to have to grow your beard back, which I think made everybody think I looked more like Richard. That's okay.
I understand you lied about your French in order to get the part of the French translator.
You've read my book. I don't know. I had spoken French in high school a bit. And when I was called in for the audition for Close Encounters, there was no acting required. It was just we talked. And then Steven Spielberg said, say something in French, because you need to be very fluent in French to do this part. And I said a few things. And then I said, il y aurait longtemps depuis que j'ai parlé français. Si vous me donnez ce boulot, ce serait très difficile pour moi. And I went on a bit, saying to him that it had been years since I'd really spoken French, and if he gave me this job, it was really going to be hard. And I didn't lie, but I said it in French, which caused him, of course, since he didn't speak any French, to believe that I was this French whiz. And he said, great, you know, you start in 2 months, and you're going to have to go to India, and I think at that time, the Gobi Desert, I mean, it was, like, amazing. And I said, yeah, okay. And I walked out, and I thought, what have I gotten myself into? Then they called and said, Francois Truffaut is going to play your vis-a-vis in this movie. And I thought, I'm going to have to lie in front of Francois Truffaut for 7 months in the Gobi Desert. And I went to Berlitz, and I brought the script to them, and I said, help me quickly. I have to both become fluent in French and translate the script into French, because nobody had done that. You know, they assumed that I was such a French wizard that I would simply take whatever dialogue there was that had to be in French and convert it into my own beautiful French. And there were things in the script like, go dust the northern face of the mountain with EZ4 and stuff like that. We really had some time of it. And there were even a few things in India that we used to have to say, which are no longer in the movie. So by the end of it, I not only got paid and got to be in really one of my favorite movies that I've ever been involved with, certainly.
Avez-vous des maux de tête, des migraines?
Having headaches, migraines.
Yeah. Irritation des yeux et du sinus.
An irritation in your eyes and your sinuses.
Yeah. Des démangeaisons, des allergies.
You have hives? You have allergies?
Des brûlures sur le visage et sur le corps.
You're burning on your face and on your body?
Yes. Who are you people?
No contest.
Yeah, I got one just like in my living room. Who are you people?
Je pensais... Oui, tu connais.
Monsieur Neri, please, one more question. N'avez-vous pas fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle.
Close encounter with something very unusual.
You come from a movie family.
Mm-hmm.
You have relatives who operated the Balaban and Katz movie theater chain?
Yeah, my father was the youngest of seven brothers who were all in some way or other involved with the chain of theaters called Balaban and Katz in the Midwest that began, I guess, in about 1915. And a lot of the theaters are still there now, although they're not called that. Then my father's oldest brother, Barney Balaban, was the president of Paramount. He left the theater chain and became a producer, a studio head,
mm-hmm.
For about 30 years, ending in the late 50s, early 60s. And my grandfather left, who was Katz, left Balaban and Katz to go to MGM and be the head of production during the sort of great musical years at MGM in the 40s and the early 50s. But I never exactly felt that I was growing up in any kind of show business atmosphere, because certainly I wasn't. I grew up in Chicago, and as far as I was concerned, they were all in some sort of mysterious business. I did get to see movies for free, and mm-hmm. I went a fair amount. But other than that, I mean, it was not consciously any large influence on my life, although, on the other hand, I was always interested in things like this. As a kid, I was a puppeteer, and You spend hours alone in my room writing these bizarre little playlets that I would put on and forced everybody to be in, and my sisters were always getting pressed into service to play parts in my little productions that I would stage in the living room, in the arch between the dining room and the living room, you know, stuff like that. But a lot of kids do that, I think.
You thought your parents were in some mysterious business. What seemed mysterious about it?
Well, I could never figure out, first of all, what producers did. I mean, I remember my...
Yeah, still people can't figure it out.
My grandfather would come about once a year for Christmas, and I would see him, and he would say, you know, when you're grown up, we'll be producers together. And I would say, great, you know, and he'd leave, and I'd go, what's a producer? What does he do? I mean, he's in his office, but he's on the phone. I still couldn't figure out what exactly it was that he did other than go to the office and talk on the telephone, which is, of course, exactly what I do all the time, is go to my office and talk on the telephone. My daughter said the other day, what do you do, Daddy? How do they pay you? What happens? You know, when it I said, well, it is kind of mysterious, but... When you're not seeing me the most, that's when I'm doing my most work. You know, when I'm directing the movie, when I'm, you know, acting in the thing that I'm, you know, that every once in a while I go away and do. That's, you know, that's when I do my work. And all the rest of the things that I do is just setting it all up and organizing it and preparing it. And that doesn't look like you're doing anything.
I'm wondering what kind of attitude your family had toward actors.
Well, I think they hid it from me, mostly. But... what I could only imagine was they thought of actors as spoiled children who made life difficult, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for my father, it didn't matter because he was not in production at all. But I think that for my other relatives who were at studios, that especially when they were at studios, which is when, you know, actors were really king in a way. You know, a studio had people under contract and they had to perform and they depended on them. I think, well... who knows? I mean, there is obviously the star system exists now probably more heavily. It's just there are less of them. But I think they thought of actors as kind of shiftless and not too responsible. And probably my parents were a little nervous about my doing this, although I always made a living at it. For some reason, from the very beginning when I started working, I could always support myself. And I think they were just basically grateful that there was something I wanted to do. And that I was able to do it.
Well, Bob Balaban, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks. It was nice being here.
Actor Bob Balaban. He's also the director of the new film, Parents. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program tonight, more about the resignation of Japan's Prime Minister Takeshita. One analyst says what we're seeing here is the slight premature changing of the political guard in Japan, a new political era beginning. We'll talk with David Keith, the actor. He's playing Oliver North in a CBS television miniseries. He says he's proud to portray an authentic American hero as opposed to what he calls Washington tofu. And we'll talk with the manager of a salmon hatchery on Prince William Sound in Alaska. Last night, they began the release of millions of salmon fry going out on their own into the waters of Prince William Sound.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. ...1989 marks the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution. There's a new book by Harvard history professor Simon Schama that refutes much of the conventional wisdom about the period. It's called Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
In his first book, The Embarrassment of Riches, An Interpretation of Dutch Culture in the Golden Age, Simon Schama had his reservations about the money-grubbing burgomasters of haughty little Holland, but he admired them too. In Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution, he hates everybody who was anybody in bloody French politics from about 1785 until Napoleon. Among those he loathes are Mirabeau and Marat, Danton and Desmoulins, Robespierre and Saint-Just, except when one of them is killing the other, in which case he finds something extenuating to say about the victim, even if it hurts. So contemptuous, in fact, is Schama of every small r Republican, small d Democrat, Girondin, Jacobin, and sans-culotte, not to mention constitutional monarchists, you'd think he was Louis XVI's best buddy. And he is, sort of. In spite of huge foreign debts, a corrupt court, an absentee king, incompetent ministries, domestic recession to the point of bread riots, and a tax system of almost unimaginable unfairness, Louis's old regime, in Sciama's opinion, was well on its way to becoming a modern capitalist state. All it needed was better middle management. It got, instead, a revolution, for which, if I'm reading Sciama correctly, it pretty much deserved the subsequent terror, and all because of a bunch of disgruntled aristocrats, egged on by the sinister hyperbole of bad actors and hack writers who'd read too much Rousseau, and so succumbed to Romanticism, with, and I quote, its addiction to the absolute and the sublime, its fondness for the vertiginous and the macabre, its concept of political energy as above all electrical, its obsession with the heart, its preference for passion over reason, for virtue over peace. It never occurs to Sciama that maybe the revolution made the revolutionaries instead of the other way around. Well, we've been here before, starting with Edmund Burke and Thomas Carlyle, and it's not surprising that that rough beast, the original sin of Romanticism, should slouch round again on the bicentennial of the Revolution, wearing the current American Empire's chic new neoconservative clothes. Beware of poetry and the passions. The head you off may be your own. Sciama expects us to ignore a civil war at the time in the French West Indies between planters and natives, several significant peasant revolts, and lots of counter-revolutionary scheming by the New Republic's royalist neighbors, and to forget everything we've learned since Burke about economics, demographics, class animus, popular democracy, and liberal traditions of free speech and assembly, as well as everything we should have known since Agamemnon and the Greeks about regicide. And yet, this very same Sciama is such a lively writer, so smitten with the prurient details of social and cultural history, from hot air balloons to the Marseillaise, pornography and the guillotine, Masonic eyes, liberty hats, truffles, Stendhal, wet nursing, the revolutionary calendar, and the hearts of heroes in agate urns, that he dragged me kicking and screaming all the way to Thermidor. I couldn't stop reading even as I stamped my foot. There hasn't been narrative history this exciting since James R. Billington in The Icon and the Axe sent up all of Russia in a hot air balloon. Citizens is intellectually reprehensible, but I loved it.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution, by Simon Sciama. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Currently on the TV series Wise Guy, you can see Paul Winfield co-starring as the head of Shakala Records. On the next Fresh Air, Winfield talks with us about his acting career, including his starring role in the film Sounder and his portrayal of Martin Luther King in a TV miniseries. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of works by British composer Sir Peter Maxwell Davies. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.